So you have to forgive me, I'm going to read from this. So good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, which I see is all of you out there, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum. I am, as Caroline said, Daniel Turteman, senior writer for CNET News, and welcome to tonight's Inforum event, Illegal You, Broadcasting, Open Sourcing, and Downloading Pirates. Tonight, we're going to tap the brains of a fine band of brigands to talk about what it means to be a pirate in the digital era that is 2010. We've assembled a unique panel to discuss modern pirates who use today's technology, whether it's illegal bootlegging, open source software sharing, or unlicensed radio broadcasts to pursue freedom of expression, information, or education. To my left, Daniel Alarcón, is that how you pronounce it? He's an accomplished author, the associate editor of Etiqueta Negra, and our book piracy expert. To his left, Daniel Monkey Roberts is the creator and founder of Pirate Cat Radio, which has been producing unlicensed radio broadcasts in the city since 1996. And to his left is Adrian Roberts, who is part of the dynamic DJ duo A plus D, together with Mysterious D, who's right there, sitting in front. Adrian is one of the producers and creators of Booty, the world's biggest bootleg mashup club night. So let's get started. All right, so here we go. I'm going to start by playing devil's advocate here and asking the simple question. We're supposed to be a law-abiding society, so why is our society so tolerant of piracy? And is that a good thing? And what about the rights of artists like Prince, Metallica, the producers of the Hurt Locker, and authors and legitimate broadcasters who think that breaking those rules is ruining things for everybody. So why is piracy good?
I guess I'm Monkey, Daniel Monkey Roberts from Pirate Cat Radio. You know, it's become a part of our daily lives. We just really don't even realize the fact that we are pirating things on a daily basis, whether that was recording something off TV, be VHS or DVD or TiVo, to steal your example from earlier, or even going and downloading music. I don't think there's a single person in this room who is not guilty of pirating music off of somebody's website. And if you aren't, you should raise your hand because you're an anomaly. But
we see no hands, by the way.
Yeah, there are no hands raised. But it really shows that there's some kind of growth in society in some way, I think, that there's an evolutional step happening societally and consciously that people really need to become aware of. And, you know, whether that's industry or artists, things in society need to shape around whatever it is that's, quote unquote, being pirated or used in a different form than it was traditionally.
Right.
I think it's kind of difficult.
This is Daniel Alarcón.
Yes. I think it's kind of difficult to talk about piracy without noting also that the very concept of intellectual property is not that old. A lot of the songs that are considered traditional songs have been pirated and used without the express written consent of the author for years. And the traditional songs people sing, in church or, chants or... And there's so much art already that exists in the commons that without attribution. I have a very complicated view of things, being that my industry, the writing industry, publishing industry, has not yet been decimated to the extent that the music industry has been decimated by.
Or just give it time.
Yeah, but it's like it'll probably happen before this show is over.
Right.
But I do believe as an artist that I'm, I have the right and the responsibility to make art in conversation with other art. And now in this particular age, I think it's easier and in some ways more interesting that you can actually literally do it in conversation with other art in really direct ways. Take a piece of art, manipulate it digitally, and see what happens. And if we as a society can get to a point where we say that is not verboten, then I think that's a step forward for art. I don't see why that would be a problem.
But go ahead.
Adrian Roberts from Booty. Also, I think we're getting to a point where we're not necessarily thinking of these art pieces. I mean, I deal with music, so I'm thinking in terms of songs and albums and stuff, but it could be almost anything. Stop thinking of it as a product. I mean, like you said, copyright is really a relatively recent invention of, in the grand scale of human history, and you know, it wasn't always a product. It was simply something that was shared, you know, and passed around. And it's I think we might be getting back to that. And we're not, it's not going to be thought of, you know, someone downloading a song isn't going to be thought of as piracy. It's simply, you know, don't think of music and art as something to be bought and sold. Think of it as promoting yourself as an artist, really.
Do you really think that we're heading in that direction? Because from what I see, you know, industry and Congress.
Well, the problem
and the FCC,
it's a Pandora's box, really. You know, the genie's out of the bottle. There's no stopping it. There will be increased regulation, increased laws to try to, you know, put a stop to it. But it's, you know, I think, you know, we have a whole generation that's grown up with the concept of buying music is completely foreign, and that's just going to keep happening.
So culture is going to stay a couple steps ahead of the
I
law.
Think so.
In other words,
yeah.
Well, I mean, I'd like to believe that, but you keep hearing these stories about people who are getting you know college students who are ending up with owing the RIAA tens of thousands of dollars for downloading a few hundred songs. I mean.
It happens, but that does happen occasionally, and it's such a PR nightmare for the who looks bad there? You know, that just makes people want to be like, well, screw you, you know, I'm going to go download as much music as possible because that is so egregiously unfair. And because it's such a part of our culture now to, you know, just go on the internet and, oh, I like that song. I want to download it. Oh,
right.
You know, I miss seeing that TV show or that movie. I want to go download it.
Daniel.
Yeah, I think there's something interesting about that. I think as an artist, the concept of property that, you know, assaults on my intellectual property that I worry about would not be, you know, someone stealing a book from a bookstore or, you know, downloading an article from somewhere or somehow not paying me directly for my work. I think it's much more worrisome when you have a gigantic company like Google going around and digitizing, you know, every book known to man and then wanting to keep the digital rights and take those away from you. That's more worrisome to me than you know, a kid downloading music. I mean, I know music and books are different, but in some ways they're the same. And, you know, the farther away we get from the printing press and the closer we get to everything being ones and zeros, they're basically the same thing. And Google worries me. That's a gigantic corporation, and they are going to make money off of my book. Whereas, you know, someone who's downloading a song or downloading a book is, you know, it's just one person.
Now, I'm not completely versed in the settlement, but under the settlement, I know you said that you opted out. But for those who opted in, is there a way for revenue to trickle down? You know.
Well, I mean, that's one of the reasons I have an agency, so I don't have to make those decisions. Basically my agency told me to opt out, and I opted out because I was not about to read that agreement. I'd rather read, you know, a story or
sure.
a poem or something. So quite frankly, I have trouble even reading my contracts.
Right.
I don't know what they gave me to sign in the green room tonight, but I signed it. So I don't know, but there must be a reason why every agency in New York told all their authors not to sign the Google book settlement.
Right. To me, a lot of this boils down to behavior in one way or another, you know, whether it's copying music or you know, as you've written about, making photocopies of books and distributing them on the streets of Peru or doing pirate radio. And I'm Monkey, let me ask you, you know, you wrote, or I saw on your website that you said that the role of the Federal Communications Commission or that the FCC has failed in its mission to, quote, promote the larger and more effective use of radio in the public interest. And I'm kind of curious, since what you do is sort of contravenes that, why do you think that you can do it better?
Because I have. Well, you know, the FCC, they're really, for one, in their own defense, extremely understaffed. And they are tasked with a plethora of different things that they're supposed to take care of for you and I and our, you know, rights to have airwaves without interference and hear the radio stations, et cetera. But, you know, as far as really paying attention to the need in large communities for smaller voices to be heard on a larger scale has been ignored. Whether that's their responsibility or not, I think it is to some extent. I mean, I think it is their responsibility to really license, come up with a scheme similar to LPFM or maybe even modify the rules.
Sorry, and what is that?
LPFM is a low-power FM stations. So this was something that I think the first bit of them came out in 2003 is when they were originally licensed. But it's a concept where a radio station would have, you know, anywhere from 10 to 100 watts. So it would serve a small populace. So the FCC did make a fetal attempt there to kind of do something. Unfortunately, a lot of those LPFMs were taken up by evangelical Christian stations or organizations, and as is the case with the majority of radio, it seems, in the U.S. But, you know, the FCC really should take a better eye to smaller groups and communities to realize that, you know, despite the fact that you have a station like, let's say, KQED, for example, they put out several thousand watts, and they cover, you know, anywhere from, what, San Luis Obispo up into the Sacramento area. So that's, despite the fact that they're providing content for the state of California, they're also taking up a lot of the FM dial for use for one station versus having smaller communities being able to utilize that same frequency and have local informative content. I mean, that's what I've done with Pirate Cat Radio is, you know, as a pirate radio station, we took a frequency that was completely dormant, 87.9 FM, and utilized that for bringing local independent artists on the air, bands that you wouldn't hear about anywhere unless you happened to fall into some dive bar on a Thursday evening, or bringing in folks that are running for office here in San Francisco. For example, the District 8 and District 9 supervisors came in and had their candidacy debates in 2008 for their election. And that was really, I think, the only on-air forum that was held for them was at Pirate Cat.
Right.
So it was with things like that that we've really pushed forward at Pirate Cat to bring to people that you wouldn't get it elsewhere.
And has that led to interactions of any kind with the FCC or other, you know, regulatory agencies?
Well, I mean, last year the FCC fined us $10,000 for broadcasting without a license. And basically, that's still something that will linger over my head for the rest of my life. But Pirate Cat's still operating as an online radio station. I mean, we actually, I hate to do some self-promotion, but we just launched a Kickstarter.com campaign to raise $60,000 in hopes of buying one of two radio stations that are available to us to purchase. Mm-hmm. So go make a pledge at Kickstarter.com.
And so does that mean, I mean, you know, I have this image in my head of that film, Pump Up the Volume, where, you know, this guy's driving around in his car, you know, broadcasting from his car.
I wish it were that exciting.
Yeah, well, so that's the thing. You're online. I mean, what is there any method for shutting you down? You
know, online?
Yeah.
I mean, it becomes a different territory at that time, online at least. The FCC is really concerned with people broadcasting illegally without a license. And here in San Francisco, or at least, you know, in the Bay Area before I got KPDO, which is my licensed radio station, the going price for a radio station was along the lines of $3.6 million here in the Bay Area. And, you know, that's something that's out of most of the common person's price range, I think, the last time I checked at least, especially in this downturn economy. So, you know, what are we supposed to do if we want to get our voices heard? You can start a blog and be one amongst a million others that right. might get read by somebody, or go on the air and start a radio station and okay. force yourself in to be heard by people scanning through the dial as they come through the Bay Area.
Right. Daniel Alarcón, can you explain a little bit about where you're coming from when it comes to piracy? Because you are an author, but you've also written this great essay on the dynamic of book piracy in Peru, and I think a lot of people here wouldn't even be familiar with the idea of what book piracy is, especially when you're talking about physical books.
Yeah, yeah. It is kind of this strange parallel universe. I was born in Lima, and I go back and spend a lot of time in Lima, and my books have been published in Lima and pirated in Lima. So it turns out there's this massive parallel industry of fake books. That exists, and it's probably larger than the actual book industry. It employs more people in the actual book industry, and it's just massive. They export books, you know, all over Peru, northern Chile, as far as away as Argentina. You know, Peruvian books have been found in Bolivia and Ecuador. I mean, it's just this massive, massive industry, and they periodically try to fight it, but they really can't shut it down. They can't make it go away. And so I entered this world, and it is sort of the ethics and the codes of the mafia or, you know, drug trafficking cartels, except around books. So on the one hand, it's feeding this hunger for this revered cultural object that everyone considers to be of utmost importance in the development of a nation. The book has this kind of hallowed aura around it. And yet, these people, bribe judges, bribe cops, fight for territory, go wreck each other's presses. It's really, really kind of seedy. And so the combination of those two things I found absolutely fascinating. And so I spent, 2 months immersed in that and then another couple months writing it.
And as an author, you must have this, sort of conflicting opinions about...
Yeah, of course. Basically being pirated in Peru is equivalent to making the bestseller list.
Yeah.
It's probably true that I sold more books in Peru than I have in the United States, even though the United States is, 10 times the size of Peru. And it's probably true the majority of the books that I've sold in Peru have been pirated copies.
And how does that make you feel?
I'm in a particularly privileged situation because I write in English and live in the United States and to the extent that I make any money at all, I make it in dollars, not in Peruvian soles. So I'm not affected financially by the way my peers, my friends who are Peruvian writers who live in that market are. But on the one hand, it's flattering. On the other hand, as a Peruano, as a Peruvian, I'm very aware that it exists within this larger context of corruption where everything is fake, fake cops, fake buses, fake taxis, fake money. And that obviously makes me it's troubling, right. So there's a scene in the piece when I finally did find the book. My most recent book had been pirated. I went up and tried and bought it, had a little argument with the guy who was selling it. And when I paid him finally, the first thing he did was take my money and hold it up to the light to see if it was real or not. And just the irony of that situation, he did it without thinking, of course. And, of course, any, vendor in any part of Lima would have done exactly the same thing. But he didn't even see the significance of that, right. Gesture.
Well, I was curious. There's something in your essay that stuck out to me that you related the story of a Peruvian author who was telling you that he hadn't been pirated yet, but he wished that that he was, or that he was going to be. And Adrian, you had talked about the same thing, that a lot of musicians feel honored by.
Well, I was just thinking, you have sold, or you're more exposed in Peru simply because of that piracy industry. And, is that not a good thing as far as exposure? Because I'm thinking, I was in a band around the time the whole Metallica thing happened with Napster, right. And how, what a big media scandal that was. And so many times I got asked, well, what if someone was stealing your music? And I'm like, please, get it out there. If... In the music industry, if you sell a million records, that's great. And, piracy doesn't actually really hurt you all that much. But it hurts the music, the music industry. But as an artist, half the time you have to sell 500,000 records before you're even close to breaking even. You're so in debt to the record label. And so for me as an artist, it was just get it out there. If the more exposure I can get, then the better. You're not even making money off your music. The music is a promotional tool to sell yourself as an artist, to get people to come to your shows, to sell T-shirts, to, there's so many different revenue streams. I think the music industry is slowly starting to realize this, that music is no longer the actual sale of music on a CD is such a small chunk of the pie because it's drying up.
Yeah, it seems like the power in the music industry is more in the Ticketmaster that's
well, that's also why record labels are now, they're not signing record deals. They're signing artists to what they call 360 deals, where it's everything. It's not just, instead of there being five different companies, to one company to sell the band's T-shirt, another one to sell tickets, another one to sell their records. Companies are now doing the whole package because they realize that music itself is simply a promotional tool to sell all of these other things.
Right, but when was the last time anyone bought like a Philip Roth T-shirt? You know, in what I do and in literature, it's just that, you know, there's no other merchandise to sell.
Well, that's true. There's not author T-shirts.
There's no author T-shirts. There's no concerts.
Right.
In defense of what Adrian's saying, actually, Monkey again speaking, when I was working for Universal Music, it was kind of cardinal knowledge that at the record label was that bands don't make money off of record sales. All the money that a band makes is really based on merchandise and touring sales. And I think a band like Kiss is a great example of that. I mean, people go to they pay tickets to go to a Kiss concert because they're going to see fires and flames and bright flashy lights and hopefully get a laser in their eye. Whereas, you know, as well, you know, you're going to go and buy the Kiss mask and the Kiss doll and whatever else. And there really aren't any bands like that now who are really trying to push the whole merchandise thing. I guess maybe Metallica did when they found out all their songs were being downloaded. You can get a Metallica action
figure.
There are so
many bands that do that. I mean, I think CD sales are not what they used to be, but I think CDs are now almost seen as a collectorist, fetishist item. Mm. You already downloaded the music for free. You already got it. And if you really like that band, then you want to support it with, oh, well, I really want the packaging. You're not paying for the music. You're paying for the packaging. You know, there are these, you know, it's already, exactly. How does that translate if you're an author or if you're, you know.
It doesn't.
Yeah,
I mean, it doesn't.
Exactly.
In the meantime, it sounds like the record companies are sort of playing both sides of this equation, right? I mean, on the one hand, they're saying, you know, don't steal our music. On the other hand, they're sort of seeding the underground.
Well, they want as much exposure for artists as possible. I mean, this we've experienced this firsthand. As mashup artists, we've been given tracks from up-and-coming artists released by major labels as a way to seed the underground, remix it. Lady Gaga is an absolute perfect example. We were given an a cappella of Just Dance, which was her first single, we weren't the only ones. I mean, this was given to DJs and producers all over. It was leaked, and before the record even came out. So DJs, producers would make remixes and make mashups, and get it out there, get it played at clubs, get it played on MP3 blogs, and gain awareness for this artist that no one had heard of. I mean, they used it literally as a promotion tool. And, of course, the great irony is then after now the artist is famous and ultimately because of that seeding, the underground, selling millions of records, now we had made a mashup of one of her recent singles, Bad Romance, that got pulled down from YouTube over and over and over again due to copyright infringement. So it's like, yeah, they definitely play it both ways.
Yeah,
if they need it to be pirated and it's good for business, then it's great. But then once the artist is established, oh, no, we don't want that anymore.
Right. I'm kind of curious. I mean, do you guys pay royalties to the artists
No, not at all. No, that is a... but we don't charge money for it either. That's sort of pirate's honor. You know, we didn't pay for the copyright clearances, so therefore neither should you. We put it on our website. We give out tons of free CDs at our clubs and parties, and we never charge money for it. I think that, you know, that's how we justify it morally. I mean, we are promoting their artists and really giving them more exposure, and we're not making a dime off.
But there's a flip side to that too, right? You're making money off your events, right?
So we're making money off of entertaining people, but we're not making money off of the music. You know, we're not charging people for the CDs or charging people for the downloads on our website. You know, they're coming to the party because it's a good party.
The question came up earlier before we started here about you guys don't want to be the test case for fair use and I was kind of curious, you know, where the Shepard Fairey case where he, you know, the Obama picture that he did that eventually turned out to have been based on an Associated Press photograph, you know, is that something that you've been paying attention to?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, because mashups fall into that. That's very much the visual equivalent of what mashup culture is, which is taking two or more songs and combining it into one song, basically creating a new work out of existing source material, which is very much what that Shepard Fairey was, in my opinion. It created a brand new work based on previous copyrighted material. But where do you... To me, that constitutes fair use. you could also say parody to a certain extent. But there's never been, at least in the music world, there's never been a landmark court case defining whether it's, you know, it's a gray area. Is it legal or illegal? Does it constitute fair use? In my opinion, the Shepard Fairey thing is absolutely fair use. It was such a derivative work. It was based on, it was such a brand new piece of artwork based on, you know, something that happened previous. But that's, you know, we were talking earlier, that's all artwork. All artwork you can trace a through line to, you know, what came before it. Nothing's original. Everything is based on something.
Right. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, I had a bunch of thoughts on that. I think the question, you mentioned Pirate's Honor, and I think that's important to differentiate between, to me the concept of fair use hinges on that concept of honor, is like how much are you adding to the conversation and distributing, you know, whatever you materials you create based on other art, how much are you contributing it to the discussion? And I think the question with Shepard Fairey was, did he get rich off of that piece, that Obama piece? Did he make a ton of money? And shouldn't he, if he did, break off to AP Photographer just a little something?
Right, it certainly raised his profile a lot.
I mean, it certainly did. If I had done that, just out of sheer, you know, good guy-ness, ethics, I would, you know, write the guy a check. But, I mean, I'm not Shepard Fairey, you know? And maybe he's not legally bound to write that AP Photographer a check, but you know, he might be ethically, morally bound to, you know, just, you know, a couple zeros, maybe four zeros. I don't know, something. But that's
thing
the
is
question.
Though that work was so widely distributed, and he didn't. Yeah, he gained reputation, and I mean, again, it's, you know, he didn't. He created a piece of artwork and distributed it very freely. I mean, everyone during that campaign season was using that image everywhere, and he didn't profit off of that at all. It promoted him as an artist, which is good. It's free promotion, mm-hmm. But he didn't. You know, the whole point was for him to just get it out there.
It's very interesting to me that, you know, he's facing, you know, potential financial liability for what he did. Meanwhile, you know, everybody in the world is now using that basic design that he created.
Oh, right. The whole red and blue,
yeah, exactly. That's everywhere. But
it's now become a, you know, it's iconic, really.
Yeah.
And again, parody. I mean, you know, everything you see there's a software plugin, you know, on your web browser, upload your photo and bam, within, you know, 2 seconds, you've got your own Shepard Fairey looking image of yourself. You know, where does that mean Shepard Fairey gets a couple pennies off every time you do that? It doesn't, actually.
Exactly. Monkey, does fair use come into play, you know, in your realm at all?
I don't think so.
No.
Fair use, pirate honor, what's that all about? That's just too romantic for me.
Yeah.
I mean, really, it's, you know, in my realm, it's a matter of, are we providing the community a service, which is the reason for Pirate Cat's continual existence, I think.
That's the pirate's honor for you then, right?
Well, I wouldn't call that a pirate's honor. That's like my duty to the you know, community that I've selected upon myself to do. But would I hold someone else beholden to that? I don't think so. But at the same time, I'm not encouraging anyone to start a pirate radio station. Was there a question out there? No? Okay. I don't think there's any nothing that relates to me as far as that's concerned, as long as I'm holding true to my mission statement, really.
Right. Was there anything that you do, you know, that or that you have done as a pirate broadcaster that has, you know, caused you some moral dilemma?
We did have this PSA running for several years on PiraCat between like 2000, 2003, which basically said, if you're listening to PiraCat radio after 2 a.m., you're guaranteed not to get a DUI. And we'd play it over and over again, and there were a few cases in Los Angeles where people would actually use that as their defense when they got pulled over. But as far as I see it, you know, if you actually go and do that and kill yourself, you get a Darwin Award for that, buddy. So,
absolutely.
People never cease to astound.
Yeah, exactly. I'm kind of curious because, you know, making a living is obviously a strong reason why people get into creating, you know, to writing books or making music or whatever. But as artists, maybe that's not the primary, you know, driver. And I'm kind of curious about, from all of you, you know, whether you think that piracy in all of these media, music, books, video games, broadcasting, even, you know, as it becomes more prevalent, it's more accepted in society, whether that's going to affect whether people choose to go into these professions and whether they choose to create art.
I think it's the profession of being an artist is different from the art of being an artist. And I think they're so different that, like right now, currently, at this exact moment, I'm in the profession of being a writer and I'm sort of expounding upon what it means. But, you know, 4 hours ago when I was at my desk writing, I had not any of this in my head. And it's such a different experience, and it's... one is so intimate, the other one is kind of public and sort of trying to raise your profile and talk about yourself and do these kinds of things that you're supposed to do, quote unquote. And you know, they both have their pleasures and they both have their challenges. But people are never going to stop doing the other one. People are never going to stop trying to make sense of the world through art. I feel like people did that before there was any possibility of earning a living at this, and they'll continue to do it no matter how difficult it becomes to make a living at it.
Sure, but there is, I mean, we are in a day and age where there is a lot of money, you know, out there in these professions and you know, people who, there is a dividing line between people who do things as amateurs because, you know, I have this novel in me, I got to get it out, and the people who are actually good enough to make money at it, and, you know.
But so many of the artists and the writers and musicians that we admire today were, quote-unquote, amateurs in their own time. Hmm. You know, we could spend the entire hour naming writers who were obscure until 20 years after they died, whose work is now considered canonical. So it's hard for me to really, with any confidence, distinguish between what is an amateur and what is a quote-unquote professional, because time will tell and history will tell, and you know, the work that persists will probably surprise us.
I mean, I guess to follow one more thought on that, I mean, the world's more expensive than it used to be, and people, you know, people have to, you know, couples have to work two jobs just to pay the rent, especially, you know, in places like the Bay Area.
Sure.
Are people going to, so, you know, while I see what you're saying, that people used to, you know, historically have been able to do that, you know, I'm wondering whether that's going to continue to be true, whether people are going to be able to afford the time to do it if they're worried that they won't be able to make a living.
I just have this sense that that's never going to go away. You know, that you know, I'm struggling, quote unquote, to write this book that I'm currently, you know, hitting my head against every day. But, you know, great books, far greater books than the one that I'll write, have been written in much harder circumstances, and, you know, in the midst of, you know, war, famine, you know. So it's like, so I'm having trouble paying the rent because someone's, you know, buying an unlicensed ebook. Well, I'll just have to deal with that, you know.
Adrian, what's your thought on that? I mean, in the music industry.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, people will always create. And quite frankly, I think it's easier for anyone. There's been such a democratization with music, with art, with video. I mean, we're looking at just 10 years ago, it would have cost my band $10,000 to record a record that I can now do with a laptop and some microphones and, you know, and put it out and have a distribution system with the internet that was not available, you know, 10 years ago. This is why the music industry is so scared, because, you know, they used to have a lock on distribution. Well, now with the internet, and it's not just music, it's video, it's movies, it's, you know, there's so many people that, you know, we call them amateurs, but ultimately if you are, you know, you're doing little webisodes of, you know, little skits and stuff, and then selling advertising on your website, and you're making a living off of that, where's the line? I mean, just because you're not being distributed through a mainstream media channel doesn't mean that you are not, you know, that you can't do it, that you're not a professional to some degree.
Right. I think we're missing some main people, though, to be a part of this forum, honestly, which is, I mean, here we are, we're all independent, kind of slightly known artist in some form. But we really don't have, like, I don't have somebody to counter anything I'm saying about starting a pirate radio station. There's not someone here from, say, Entercom or Clear Channel right. to speak on their behalf, or maybe an engineer for a local radio station that has to deal with the interference from a pirate radio station. We don't have, say, who's a local San Francisco artist, maybe somebody like Tom Waits here right now saying how he feels about his music being pirated. So it's great for us who are here on this level, but you know, we get our exposure when people pirate our work, et cetera, or in any capacity. But what happens when you reach that higher echelon? Exactly. Who's protecting you at that stage? That's your income. That's how you do whatever it is that you do and live the lifestyle you've learned to live.
Well, you said you actually used to work in the record industry, right? Mm. For Universal, you said? Yep. So you've been in that world. Put on that hat for a minute. What are they thinking?
Well, so as far as the whole BitTorrent concept, their method would be to covertly send out their latest singles or half of one of their albums as a zip file or as MP3s and put them out there for people to download to create buzz. They use that internally to just virally spread something that's not released yet. It's a deliberate marketing tactic that they use. But do they dislike it? Yeah, they do. That's why you see all of these. You can go online and find a plethora of websites very quickly that show like why you shouldn't pirate and why pirating's bad and illegal and you're going to go to jail for it. But you know, I think what even at this level is as consumers who download music and videos regularly and as artists who are trying to share our content, it's our responsibility to kind of help guide, you know, the Congress and Senate to come up with some kind of scheme that will provide a taxation on us possibly of some kind and then help artists at another level. I mean, like such a thing like voluntary collective licensing. Mm-hmm. This hasn't been something that's proposed. I mean, there's a bill that was supposed to go through Congress and Senate this month or this week, which is the Combating Online Infringement and Counterfeits Act, which is just horribly named.
Yeah, what's the acronym for that?
I think the GOP didn't name that one. They come up with catchier names, unfortunately. But you know, that's something that was supposed to go through.
And no license left behind.
Yeah, I mean, who knows what the effects of that's going to be? But you know, the Parliament in England just is trying to pass a law where they want all ISPs in the UK to bear 25% of the cost to enforce online piracy protection. And I mean, I don't think we want to see a taxation of our ISPs in the US of 25% more, so you know, we can have people kept from downloading things. Wouldn't it be better if we voluntarily or somehow added to our internet service costs every month, paid an additional dollar or two?
Well, that's something I wanted to ask about. I mean, we're more than 10 years past Napster, right? And, you know, while there are lots and lots of places to download music, the best places to do it legally is iTunes and Amazon and things like that. And I'm, you know, and for movies, you know, you've got Netflix and, streaming and stuff. And I'm, you know, I'm constantly like slapping my forehead wondering why the record companies and the movie studios and even the book publishers, you know, haven't figured out some way to do, you know, these all-you-can-eat plans that people have been talking about for years. You know, I mean, let me just ask the audience. I mean, looking at music, you know, how many people here would pay $10 a month for, you know, to get all the music that you wanted?
Well, they've done that with Rhapsody, except that it's such...
But you don't control the music, right?
You can download whatever you want, but unfortunately, once you're no longer a subscriber, then you can no longer...
Right. And by the way, about half the people in the room raised their hand.
Exactly.
Right. About half the people in the room raised their hand, by the way. So you were saying, I'm sorry.
They haven't found the right system to do that. They should, but they're still so... It's hard for them to let it all go to a certain degree.
It seems like that would be a way to raise tremendous amounts of money. I mean, if everybody... Not everybody, but you know, millions of people were putting...
I mean, I think people will pay for convenience. I mean, as much as I download free music, I just bought two albums off of iTunes simply because I wanted to write then and there and did not want to go digging around the internet for it. And that was worth $10 to me. Mm-hmm. You know? So I think ultimately if you, it's finding that price point convenience, you know, factor.
You know, to give you a and again, the books is sort of what I know to the extent that I know anything. A little behind the scenes information that I've heard from when I go to New York and talk to people is that the agencies and the book publishers can't sort of get together and do that because that's antitrust. So whereas Amazon basically has, until the appearance of the iPad, had the ebook market cornered, the different agencies had to each go, you know, to Seattle or wherever they are and talk to the Amazon people individually. And if they were to do some kind of like collective thing, they would get sued. And so they were totally hamstrung, and it was, you know, kind of unfair negotiating.
Just one thing, we're almost out of time. We've got about 5 minutes left. So if you're going to have questions, we'll take them at the mic. So maybe line up for that right now.
Could I?
Yes, please continue.
Because Monkey was asking about, you know, we don't have these other people on the other side of this issue. But I did spend a lot of time when I was in sort of talking about or investigating this piracy issue in Peru, talking to book publishers. And, you know, I talked to a man who, you know, he had published Mario Vargas Llosa and Alfredo Bryce Echenique, the two best-selling authors in Peru, for years. And he, by all rights, should have been a wealthy man. I mean, you know, these people sell gazillions of copies. And he was basically broke, you know. He hadn't made any money. He had, you know, invested a ton in trying to, you know, to promote these writers, had done it very successfully, and yet he was, you know, being pirated. The day that Mario Vargas Llosa's novel Feast of the Goat came out in Peru in 2000, that same day there were 7 different pirated editions available on the streets. And so when he started talking about piracy, I mean, the man, like, fire in his eyes, you know, it was just like the raving anger of a lunatic who has been wronged. And it had kind of driven him a little batty, frankly. And with good reason, I think. He was furious. It had pretty much ruined his life.
Let's turn the tables a little bit and say, for people who are interested in piracy, what are some good places, you know, beyond the obvious, you know, BitTorrent and you know, things like that, to go to find, you know, the content they want? You don't have to identify yourselves when you answer this one.
Well, I just found out that one of PirateCat's many servers got a cease and desist for basically our music department. Every new CD or MP3 that we have to download, we put on a server for all of our DJs to share. These weren't supposed to be indexed by any search engine, but they just happened to be. And, well, I think it was DreamHost that actually gave us a cease and desist for having a handful of MP3s on there that were getting pretty heavy hits.
So what do you do about that? I mean, how does that play out?
We create a different server with a specific login.
Now, you talked about the fact that your servers are based in England, right? Or in
That's
the UK.
Right.
So why is that?
Well, one of the ways, what really got me afraid is when I heard that the U.S. was considering creating laws for online radio stations to have to pay per listener, per song, specific royalty fee. That and, you know, the laws on podcasting and using copyrighted material in a podcast that's readily available for downloads is still somewhat questionable. So just to protect ourselves, in case anything was to ever happen, we started hosting all of our online streams out of the UK. We have our podcasts hosted out of the UK, just so we're then beholden to EU and, you know, United Kingdom rules versus that of the U.S., and I doubt that I personally will be extradited to the U.K. for any illegal downloads that are taking place over there.
So are there, in the EU, the rules are a little bit less strict, or you know?
Well, if they are, how are they going to get me over here?
And so you know, are you ready to, like, you know, transfer everything over to servers in another, you know, part of the world if that's required?
That's one thing to do. Yeah, why not? I mean, that we already have. We've
Peru's
got
probably a good place.
Yeah, Peru. Why not? I mean, Kazakhstan's safe. They have a major pipe running through that country. Why not?
Right. 2 minutes. Any further thoughts from you guys?
I'm fascinated by the. I just wanted to clarify, Monkey. So the actual radio that I can hear on the radio dial is no longer functioning because of the FCC, or it's still functioning, or are you allowed to?
If it is functioning, it's not because of me.
Okay. So, and this was a question I had when you were talking. I was like, in the age of sort of ubiquitous Wi-Fi and broadband streaming, is like, do you still need a presence on the 87.9, or like, why not just have an online radio station?
It's hard to quantify what our actual listenership is on the FM dial when we were pirating. But, you know, we were able to calculate that roughly for every phone call we got, there was anywhere from 10 to 100 people calling, depending on the time of day. So, you know, if you're doing a show at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and you're being broadcast on 87.9 FM, you say, hey, call in now, get some tickets, you'll get a bunch of phone calls. And that showed that we had a higher listenership. Now that we're just online, we don't get that instantaneous gratification of having people listening live. Yeah. A majority of our listeners, I think, are all to a podcast. I mean, when I checked last week, our podcast downloads were at 536,000 unique downloads, and that's of about 52 shows. So, you know, as far as broadcasting on air, it's still the cheapest form of communication you have. You can go and buy a radio for $5 or less and pick up any station within your broadcast range, and PirateCat just happened to be one of those for a period of time.
And you aspire to get back to that? That's what you're raising money for?
To do it legally, yeah. That's what we're trying to raise money for.
Right on, okay.
And where are things with that right now? I mean, what's the prospects of that?
Well, we're only 10 days into the fundraising so far. We've raised nearly $1,000, but so far I have some people that are saying if we reach particular goals, they're willing to put in anywhere from $20,000 from one person to $5,000 for another. So...
good. Well, I think have reached the 45 minutes of our discussion time, and so I'm supposed to read this. We're going to turn it over to audience questions for a little while, but before I do that, I want to remind our audience that this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum, and tonight we're hosting Illegal You, Broadcasting, Open Sourcing, and Downloading Pirates, a discussion with Daniel Alarcon, Daniel Monkey Roberts, and DJ Adrian Roberts. And I'm Daniel Turtleman, tonight's moderator and senior writer for CNET News. So, if there are any questions from the audience, hopefully, no one's standing up. Okay, well, here's one.
Hello. So, to me, it seems like most of the piracy laws that exist at the moment are not really to protect people like me or the normal people or even most artists. It seems that they generally protect huge rich corporations, for example, like the FCC, mostly, you know, by cracking down on small pirate stations, they're actually just protecting huge national, multinational broadcasting companies. I don't know if you agree, so I guess that's my question is, you know, as an author, maybe you don't agree with me, but do you think that the current piracy laws do protect, like, the normal people and the average artist? And if not, what do you think is a better way? Should we get rid of all piracy laws, or is there some that you would keep, or how would you change them?
Well, I mean, I'd say I personally am a proponent of the voluntary collective licensing fee. So some kind of additional fee put in place for example, for online downloads, say that there's a nonprofit that's created and some kind of fee put on to your ISP for downloads every month. So whether you are posting music online or you're a publisher of a book that's being downloaded for free, somehow within that system, money would be distributed to artists who join whichever collective agency. This would be kind of outside of BMI and ASCAP, I guess.
And what are those, by the way, BMI and?
Oh, BMI is Broadcast Music Industry, and ASCAP is the only acronym that comes to mind is something that would get bleeped.
But they're licensing agencies.
The other thing is Creative Commons is a form of copyright that exists. I wish it existed more. I don't think any large corporation will ever truly embrace it, unfortunately. But if they did, it's a great way as an artist to allow your work. You specify how your work is copyrighted, if especially as a mashup artist who takes other people's works and creates new work and then, you know, distributes it for free. If an artist allowed their copyright to be under a Creative Commons license, they would allow that. It wouldn't be piracy. It would be like, oh, you want to take my work, remix it, mash it up, do what you want, and as long as there's not money changing hands, then I will allow you to do that. And there's different levels that you can, different rules that you can apply to your Creative Commons copyrighted work.
That's really the key.
It's a really great thing, but I think it'll It'll probably be a cold day in hell when a big multinational corporation fully embraces Creative Commons.
But that really is the key, though, is the no money changing hands, right? I mean, that's...
But, you know, as an artist, you could also be like, you know what, go ahead, you know, do whatever you want with my work, and if you make money at it, more power to you. I mean, you have that option as well. But I do think, you know, as far as piracy goes, I mean, that to me is sort of the crux of it. I mean, it's a little bit of Robin Hood, you know, steal from the rich and just, you know, put it out there. But like I said, companies are figuring out different ways to make money. The industry is fundamentally changing because of piracy.
I mean, I was just thinking the last big raid that happened in Peru happened because Paulo Coelho complained because his book was out in Lima before it had actually been published in Spanish anywhere in the world. In fact, someone stole the translation from the publishing house in Spain and printed it up on the streets of Lima before it had that translation had even been corrected. So these pirates are very sophisticated. One, and two, Paulo Coelho is a heavyweight in the publishing world, unfortunately, and so he was able to you know get the entire police structure to move, and it was, you know, the next day the books were back on the shelves. I mean, it was completely.
So there's very little that can be done in Peru, at least it sounds like.
I mean, at least in Peru, there's nothing that can be done that I've ever. I mean, no one I ever talked to sort of thought, oh yeah, we'll you know, vanquish this plague.
Right. Next question.
A couple of things. One, I just wanted to make a distinction between single copy piracy and counterfeiting. Because what you guys are talking about, the stuff with making all those books in Peru, whatnot, or stealing software, you know, selling copies of Office or whatnot, that's not piracy, really. That's counterfeiting. You know, it's not quite the same thing. Single copy piracy doesn't hurt anybody. You know, I want to try the new version of Word. I want to try a new version of AutoCAD. I download it. I use it. If it's cool, I buy it. If it's not, I delete it.
I think that's true. And there's also something else that the wholesale copying of a book and selling it on the street is very different from what Adrian's doing, which is, you know, creating something new. I mean, that's absolutely true.
And the second thing is, I'm glad you mentioned Creative Commons because that's one of the things I was going to do standing up here. There's four different levels of Creative Commons you can assign to a work. And if you don't know who Lawrence Lessig is,
yeah.
Go home and look him up and do a search for Lessig and Creative Commons. He's made some really great presentations on intellectual property and what's going on with the music industry and the movie industry and all that kind of stuff. That's my head. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. This has been really fascinating. I've enjoyed it. And one of the things that came to my mind is how recent copywriting and just this whole industry of getting, or musicians getting paid and writers getting paid. I mean, it's a relatively few years. I mean, when you look at most of human history, books got burned. It was all about control. Songs were lost. I mean, I was thinking about, oh my God, how much has actually been lost throughout the course of time?
Right.
And it's only in this very brief moment, I don't know how many years it is myself, I would like to hear your thoughts on it, this brief moment in time when we have this incredible amount of freedom and information and the ability to express all of it. I know it's a real dilemma because I definitely believe that people should be paid for their work. It's just such a relatively new thing. But in that process, it seems to me that in past times, an artist or a writer would have to have a patron. And the patron would have to like what the artist or writer was or musician was doing. So they were censored. When you look at these music companies and you look at the publishers today, well, that's your patron. And you're always going to be a little bit censored. There's always, in any culture, there's always been such a need to censor and to create a mindset that fits in with the rest of the culture. And censorship has always been a huge thing since the beginning of time.
Well, if I could, I think that there's a massive opening now, so that you know, and this is a, both a good thing and a bad thing, you know, that anybody now can open a blog and write anything they want, and while technically Blogspot might own your words, in practice Blogspot doesn't care at all what you write. They just want to have a number of unique users and be able to put little ads on the sides, you know. So they don't really, you know, it's sort of like freedom of speech by default, by the, you know, the massification of it and the scale of it. So in that sense, there is, you know, you don't really need to look very far to see how many ridiculously dumb blogs there are, people just saying whatever's on their minds. But the downside, apart from the stupidity of it, of a lot of the stuff that gets written and the kind of mediocrity of it, is that then how do you stand out? And I think that's something Adrian mentioned too, right?
Well, I mean, you always hope that, you know, cream rises to the top, and
maybe it does, but you know, maybe it doesn't.
But that, you know, this, you actually confirm
one last
what
part of this, which I'm going to continue on.
Can you put it in the form of a question?
I will. And what are your thoughts about, I mean, this idea? I mean, let's face it, with the level of technology, Big Brother is just around the corner, and how do you think that is going to affect all of this?
So to try to answer all of your questions, I mean, the common law concept of, or the English common law concept of copyright has really only existed since about 1709, what we recognize today. And that's been really modified and changed in the past 30 to 40 years based on different recording mechanisms for copying content, whether it be books or audio recordings. Now, as far as the Internet's concerned, the Internet's like the new Library of Alexandria, basically. We have everything we have there at any given time, and it's really our responsibility to make sure that things like net neutrality stays intact so we have open Internet access and people aren't censoring what we have. We don't want to have I don't think we want to have a great wall of the U.S. like they have in China for the Internet. Or a great firewall, excuse me.
Great firewall of China.
But, you know, that's, I think, something that we should all be able to do here on an individual basis, is to stand up for net neutrality and to make sure that we don't have our content censored. You know, as far as, you know, the, you know, underdog becoming the big dog with their content online, it's all a convoluted mishmash, and it's like random happen chance. You have to come up with your viral YouTube video or something to get known, I think. The last part of your question was?
Well, just, I don't know where all of this is going in terms of, we're really
coming
into very interesting times. It's just kind of up in the air.
The Big Brother thing is, you know, basically, there's not one Big Brother. There's not, like, in China, they have the Chinese government monitoring, watching everything.
When I say Big Brother, I'm talking about the ability for small groups of people to control and persuade. And, I mean, it's been brought to a, we're just faced with huge changes that technology is bringing about to control populations. And because censorship has always been a part of art, literature, and music, what do you think the future holds?
I actually think that it's just the opposite. Technology is allowing, I mean, there's going to be a revolution in Iran probably very, very shortly, because people have access to the tools to be able to, you know, videotape, upload it to YouTube, get it out to a global audience, and, you know, they don't have a great firewall of China, you know.
And there's this very idealist concept of
you know, that all of this technology is going to further democratize everything.
But we have to be careful, because they want to shut it down. There's a lot of people all over, and they will find very valid reasons to shut it down, just because they do not want to lose the control.
We have to fight.
I mean, you know, I'm just saying, as a society, if we want to remain free in terms of our expression and our art. So
I want to put what she's saying in sort of a more focused question, which is, you know, can you imagine, you know, technology moves at such a rapid pace, you know, what's this dynamic going to look like in 2 years? I mean, things are moving so fast. Are we going to recognize the state of piracy and regulation about it, you know, in 2 years?
I think the laws are quite clearly way behind the reality.
Way behind the technology.
We need industry to evolve as well, and to realize that the old ways just aren't going to work, and they have to evolve with new media.
at all costs.
Is that realistic, though? I mean, we've seen industry fail to...
If, say, for example, if the record industry wants to exist as the industry it's been in the past, as this large conglomerate, then they're going to have to adapt and evolve. If they don't do that, it's going to be their demise.
I think in the book publishing industry, it's a little bit more complicated because I do think people are reading more. I just don't think that necessarily the old business model is going to hold. And then where the, I mean, that's another hour, so maybe I shouldn't even get into it. But I do think that in 2 years it's going to be a little bit bleaker than it is now, which is why I'm trying to finish my novel soon.
There you go.
Business models change. I mean, she brought up the concept of, you know, artists used to be sponsored by patrons. You know, I mean, that was a whole different business model of how you as an artist made money, you know, and now it's like you're not necessarily making money off of your work because your work ends up getting pirated and put out there, but yet you're being exposed to a greater degree than you ever probably would have been before, and so you end up, you know, somehow making money in other ways based on that, you know, exposure and notoriety.
So we've got 1 minute left, and so I'm going to close with this. It's a new tradition of Inforum in 2010 that we're asking all speakers the following question. So for each of you, for Daniel, for Monkey, and for Adrian, what is your 60-second solution to change the world?
Well, since we have 60 seconds for the three of us, so
right.
I would say I would just like to see more literature translated, period.
Say, recognize mainstream media and find a way to separate yourself from it.
Use up fossil fuels as quickly as possible so we can start finding real ways to have sustainable energy.
There you go. And I'd like to add my own to that, which is that I think we need to stop thinking in short term. You know, everything is so caught up in right now, right now, right now. And I think that if people start looking a little bit farther down the road, some of the problems might resolve themselves a little bit easier. So I think we're out of time. If you are not already a member of the Commonwealth Club or Inforum, please consider joining Inforum. And for just $6 a month, you can receive perks and discounts to every Commonwealth Club event and help to support this valuable nonprofit. And now, this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.